Recent doping allegations concerning Tour de France winner Floyd Landis and track star Justin Gatlin are just the latest examples of the controversy over performance-enhancing drugs. On today's Please Explain, we're going to focus on the science and ethics of performance-enhancing drugs, and with me now are Dr. Gary Wadler, who serves on the World Anti-Doping Agency's Prohibited List and Methods Committee. WADA is the organization, and Dr. John Hoberman, a cultural historian and professor at the University of Texas and author of several books, including Testosterone Dreams, which is published by the University of California Press, and I'm very pleased to welcome them both to Please Explain today. Hello.
Good afternoon.
So let's start off with the latest news in doping, Floyd Landis. Does his second positive drug test mean there's no doubt he has used performance-enhancing drugs?
Well, he actually has had two different types of tests done. They really address the question from two perspectives. One looks at what his normal levels of testosterone in his body are, and the way we do that is to measure that substance, testosterone, against a related substance, which generally have a fixed relationship one to the other, and that's the so-called TE ratio. The other approach uses a totally different methodology and asks a slightly different question. It asks the question, is the testosterone in the body, in the individual's body, exclusively his own, manufactured from his own testicles, or is it something that is a pharmaceutical derivation, that is, it was manufactured and then administered to the body in a variety of ways, such as by injection or patch or cream and so on. So when both are positive, it's a hard burden to prove that some doping offense did not occur, although I'm sure we'll get into it. How we define doping is not as straightforward as it may seem.
Is there any possibility that his explanation that he naturally produces high levels of testosterone is true?
Well, there's two reasons to call that into question. One, he's been tested numerous times, and that TE ratio has never, as far as we know, has ever been elevated. And suddenly to have that kind of aberration would argue strongly against that having another explanation. So,
but what about, Dr. Wadler, what about autologous doping? Couldn't he take his own testosterone and then re-inject it in his body? And
no, I mean, people have done that with blood, but I've never heard it done with a substance within the blood, such as testosterone. The real explanations are not completely there. I mean, there's no question in my mind that testosterone was introduced into his body, pharmaceutical-grade testosterone. The question is how it happened and what his explanations are, and that gets to the heart of what doping is. According to the World Anti-Doping Agency, the presence of a prohibited substance, irrespective of intent, is considered to be doping. The issue that is going to, there are two issues that really need to be addressed as this moves forward. One, was there a doping substance in his body? And if the answer is yes, he was deemed to have doped. And if you dope, then you really lose the medal because you are participating in a performance that was, in fact, enhanced. The second question will be related to how long a sanction or penalty he should have.
But could it have been sabotage? Could someone have spiked his water bottle, for example?
Well, the answer is yes, it could be sabotage. It would be highly unlikely it would be through a water bottle, since most testosterone is digested in the intestinal and in the stomach.
Mm-hmm.
So it could have been a cream or a patch or a lozenge, so-called a troche, between the cheek and the gums, that's a possibility. However, under WADA rules, the individual has to prove how that substance got into his body. You just can't make an abstract statement out of context, simply say, well, I didn't do it, somebody must have done it to me, and end of story.
Let's put this in historical context for a moment and bring in Dr. John Hoberman. Dr. Hoberman, I've read that ancient Greek athletes used to eat sheep's testicles to enhance their performance. So is this something that's gone back a long, long time?
Yeah, that's a story that I've read. I think the larger point has to do with the level of ambition that is brought to athletics. The sports world that we know goes back to about the 1890s, and that is when the use of powerful drugs, including heroin and cocaine, strychnine, started to be used by distance cyclists in order to relieve pain and increase energy. So that the scandals that have cascaded on us in recent weeks are the tip of a very large iceberg that extends back to sort of the infancy of the whole idea of the high-performance athlete in the 1890s.
But testosterone is a more recent development. Weren't there rumors that East German athletes, both male and female, were using testosterone or something similar as early as the 1950s?
No, not as early as the 1950s.
Well, when was it that they started questioning whether some of those women who were doing so well, especially weightlifters, weren't taking male hormones?
Well, there's no doubt that literally thousands of East German athletes were administered anabolic steroids starting, say, late 60s, early 70s. I remember the 72 Olympics in Munich. A Swedish doctor took one look at the female East German swimmers and said, these people are on some sort of androgenic drug. They're on testosterone. They're on an anabolic steroid. And, of course, he was right. What's surprising is that it took the sports world so long to react to this observation.
How long have there been anti-doping laws on the books?
The International Olympic Committee started testing for drugs in a very crude way in 1968. The first anti-doping laws that I'm aware of date from the mid-60s in Belgium and France, and these were aimed at the doping practices. Amphetamines, for example, among the Tour de France riders, the professional cyclists.
Well, the first case I remember, maybe that's because it was the one that got the most press, was when Ben Johnson was stripped of his Olympic medal in 1988. He was using Stanozol. That was 18 years ago. Was that the most celebrated case, or was that just the one that sticks out in my memory?
No, I think you're right to emphasize the Ben Johnson case of 1988. That was certainly the turning point in terms of enforcement, in terms of sports officials finally waking up to the seriousness of the problem. And when you look at some of the steroid-dependent track and field throwing records, you look at that longitudinally, you can see that once the Ben Johnson scandal hit at the end of 1988, it did lead to some improvement in doping control such that records, a lot of records set in the 1980s have never been broken because the surveillance of steroid use has improved to some degree.
We're talking with Dr. John Hoberman, cultural historian, professor at University of Texas, and author of, among his books, Testosterone Dreams, which is published by University of California Press, and with Dr. Gary Wadler, who serves on the World Anti-Doping Agency's Prohibited List and Methods Committee on today's Please Explain. In a few minutes, we'll be taking your calls about doping science and ethics and related matters at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Dr. Wadler, now all these athletes know that they're going to be tested. Why do you think they continue to use performance-enhancing drugs? And are we talking mostly about steroids, or are there other performance-enhancing drugs as well?
Well, the question of why is, it's almost beyond understanding.
Well, do you think that they imagine they'll get away with it?
Clearly, they know they're going to be tested.
Mm-hmm.
Do they have this sense of invincibility that somehow they're going to escape that? It's very hard to explain, particularly as we have more systematically implemented anti-doping rules and regulations and the introduction of out-of-competition testing so that you're really subject to testing, in many cases, 365 days a year, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So it's very hard to understand why they would continue to do that, but the history, I think, and John Hoberman knows it better than anybody, indicates that they do continue to do it. They try to have new ways to try to beat the laboratories and the testing, whether it be masking agents, which are much overstated, or being very subtle in how they use these drugs. We've heard much, for example, about the 4-to-1 ratio. There are ways to stay under a 4-to-1 ratio and still have elevated levels of testosterone. With regard to cycling, one of the real important drugs of abuse is so-called EPO, meaning erythropoietin, which causes the red cells in the body to increase. Because they can increase too high and really result in catastrophe of heart attacks and stroke, there's been some limits in how much you can increase it. Well, to be sure, we've seen people nudge up to the line where there's a consequence of having it too high. So they've gotten very sophisticated in trying to obviate the testing. And there's, for example, human growth hormone, which, as you know, the professional sports in the United States refused to allow a blood test for. Well, to be sure, without question, there's human growth hormone being abused in sports where human growth hormone is not being tested for. So, and, you know, when gene therapy was first, and certainly in its infancy now, but first introduced conceptually, some of the very first people to reach out to the research scientists were doping gurus who were advising athletes and seeking how they can take advantage of these new therapeutic breakthroughs. In fact, if you look back at the history of doping, the advances in modern medicine and therapeutics have enabled this whole area of doping to blossom.
But I remember having Scott Hamilton on this show, mm-hmm. and he got into ice skating because he had been very small, and he took human growth hormones mm-hmm. and got taller, and they told him to do something, some physical exercise that would strengthen his bones as he was gaining growth. And so that would have been in his system. If he had been tested, wouldn't he have been disqualified, even though it surely had nothing to do with what he had done to win as a great ice skater?
Well, that's a very good question, but it gets to the heart of a concept that we use in anti-doping. That's called therapeutic use exemptions. It is not the intent of anti-doping to keep people who need legitimate medicines for legitimate medical purposes from taking them. But you have to apply for an approval before the fact. So that if somebody, in fact, had a growth hormone deficiency and needed growth hormone, there's no question that can be documented medically, and you can set up a program whereby it's monitored to make sure he was taking therapeutic amounts. If an individual has testicular cancer and had their testicles removed, and there are such cases in the Olympic movement, where they needed testosterone replacement, there's no question they can get a therapeutic use exemption to use what would otherwise be a performance-enhancing drug. You must use it in accordance with therapeutic parameters. You can't take, because you have an ability to use it, doesn't give you a license to abuse it. And so there is no question that there is a mechanism for people with diabetes to take insulin, people with growth hormone deficiency to take growth hormone, the people who are deficient in testosterone to take testosterone. That's not the intent. The intent here is a level playing field and not to cheat.
Dr. Hoberman, how is testosterone developed and administered?
Well, it is made by pharmaceutical companies. It has been made by pharmaceutical companies since the late 1930s, 1940s.
Synthesized?
The synthetic version was first produced in the laboratory in 1935 mm-hmm. And went into limited clinical testing in this country in the late 30s. The certain pharmaceutical companies are pushing it as a male menopause therapy in medical journals in the early 1940s. That did not take off at that time, but reappeared 50 years later in the mid-90s. And so There is now a very substantial testosterone market for so-called anti-aging therapies that are legal off of doctors' prescriptions.
And how does it work for athletes?
It builds muscle. I mean, the anabolic function of this hormone is in association with sufficient training to build muscle. There are anecdotal accounts of its promoting stamina, aiding recovery. It is certainly, in some people, a psychogenic drug that can boost self-confidence, levels of aggression. That is not necessarily a predictable side effect, but there are too many substantiated stories of elevated anger levels as a result of the abuse of androgenic drugs.
There are also other side effects, aren't there? We have heard about impotence as a possible side effect. Is that possible? Taking a male sexual hormone would make somebody impotent?
Yeah, because there's a feedback loop that is going to shut down the natural testosterone production. There can be shrinkage of the testicles. This is documented because you're interfering with the normal endocrinology of your own body. It's really aberrant behavior from a medical point of view.
Dr. Wadley, you wanted to add something.
If I might add, one of the ways testosterone is metabolized in the body, it is converted by a process called aromatization into the female hormone estrogen. So it can almost in a predictable fashion recognize that individuals who are abusing testosterone begin to develop breast tissue, will stop manufacturing sperm, as was indicated, will have a reduction in the size of their testicles, may in fact develop a high-pitched voice, all because, in essence, they are increasing the estrogen level, the female hormone, in their body while they're abusing the male hormone, testosterone.
So an athlete really wants to win that badly that they're willing to risk impotence, testicle shrinkage, and all the other things that you described. What about for female athletes?
Well, they get masculinized. They get a deep voice. They get acne. They get a male hair pattern. Their breasts will atrophy. They will stop having menstrual cycles. They will become masculinized. And so it's I think a great deterrent for many to recognize that these things are going to happen, and they are going to happen. Not with all forms of anabolic steroids, but with testosterone.
We'll take a little break, and when we come back, we'll be taking your calls at 212-433-9692. My guests are Dr. Gary Wadler, who serves on the World Anti-Doping Agency's Prohibited List and Methods Committee, and Dr. John Hoberman, author of Testosterone Dreams, which is published by the University of California Press. He's a professor at the University of Texas in Austin. Stay with us. And we're back with Please Explain. We're talking about performance-enhancing drugs with Dr. Gary Wadler, who serves on the World Anti-Doping Agency's Prohibited List and Methods Committee, WADA. They are the people who tested Floyd Landis. And Dr. John Hoberman, who's a historian, professor at the University of Texas, and author of Testosterone Dreams, which is published by the University of California Press. Our phone number, 212-433-9692. Kathy from Dumont, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the Leonard Lopate Show.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, Kathy, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I have competed in bodybuilding in the past, and I did get into the steroid scene, and I can say I am very sorry that I did, and I'm trying to warn people against beginning, because as the doctor said, the side effects are a lot to contend with. I experienced all the side effects that he mentioned as female experiences, and I've also dated male bodybuilders and I have seen their side effects, and it's really not worth it for a few trophies.
Now, how did you wind up getting the steroids in the first place? Did a coach give them to you, a trainer?
A fellow competitive bodybuilder turned me on to them and kind of guided my short career, as it was. And it was a lot of fun at first watching my body change, which is why I think so many people get into it, because you get very fast results. But then I started noticing the side effects, and it really scared me.
And how long does that last? Has your body returned to something approaching normal?
Well, I last competed in 1998, and I'm still undergoing electrolysis for facial hair. So it's really been a long-lasting problem.
Do you want to ask any questions, Dr. Wadler or Dr. Hoberman?
Well, the only question I have is how, I'm sorry, the bicyclist name, the cyclist who just won the...
Floyd Landis.
How can he possibly deny that he used it when the test came through? How can he continue to deny it?
Well, I will have to leave that up to Mr. Landis and his experts to try to come up with an explanation. Obviously, there was something wrong in that he had pharmaceutical-grade testosterone in his body. The question is, how did that happen? And I think we do owe the athletes, a fair hearing. The facts have to get out, and the due process has to be provided. And you know, most of the efforts to have anti-doping have been led by clean athletes. In a study recently of around 150,000 individuals whose bloods went through water labs and urines went through water labs, only about 2% were positive. Most athletes are clean. They want to compete in a level playing field. But when an accusation is forthcoming, I think we owe them every opportunity to make their case, and we're very, very methodical about that.
But Dr. Hoberman, haven't we heard some pretty wild claims? I remember hearing that one person said that the testosterone had entered his bloodstream when he was still in the womb from his twin.
Well, this was the Tyler Hamilton case, where he claimed that blood that was not his originated in the vanished twin. This is one of the most exotic alibis ever heard in the history of doping cases. There was the shot putter who ate the chicken in Lisbon, which supposedly had gotten hormones from the farmer. The one of the saddest things about this entire situation is that it forces us to confront something that more than ever today is clear about high-performance sport, and that is that it generates a lot of lying from people we do not want to hear lies from. I've been in this business for 20 years. I am still having to force myself to suspend disbelief and to believe that this many people at the top of a difficult sport are willing and able to lie through their teeth.
But what about the other side? Ben Johnson said last week, because I'm sure people wanted to ask him his opinion, he said the spectators don't care. All they want to see is the world's fastest man. That's the way life is, and people have to come to terms with that and just enjoy track and field.
Well, Ben Johnson, of course, has his own emotional stake in offering a self-exculpating alibi like that. I think it is more accurate to say, based on the survey data that are available, that the so-called public is deeply split over this. There are, according to the data, quite substantial minorities among those surveyed who will say, maybe a third at this point in one New York Times poll, that, you know, if professional athletes want to use performance-enhancing drugs, that's okay with me. If you get closer to the epicenter of the Barry Bonds phenomenon, you ask San Francisco Giants fans, as was done not so long ago, do you really care whether Barry Bonds is getting all those home runs with the help of steroids? 52% said, I really don't care. So there's the deeper the emotional stake, the more emotional gratification that spectators are going to get out of athletic performances, the more tolerant they are. An awful lot of people line the roads each year at the Tour de France, many of them for many years now knowing full well that the dubious pharmacological practices went into those performances. So we're at a very awkward, difficult stage at this point where the demand for performances from corporate sponsors and from politicians and from the public so-called are colliding with the war on drugs doctrine that says our lives should be drug-free.
A listener has emailed us this question. He says an article he read said that using testosterone over such a short period of time, that is, a one-shot deal, would not provide the kind of performance that Landis had. Is that true? Do steroids need a while to have an effect,
well,
or can it be used to enhance performance overnight? Or are there short-term and long-term uses of these performance-enhancing drugs?
Well, that's one of the questions which is out there, and I've said repeatedly that things just don't add up completely in this case. Certainly, classically, people who use anabolic steroids, particularly for strength purposes, take them in what we call those cycles, which may run 6, 10, 8, 12 weeks, and then take a respite, let their body recover, and take them again. They do this while they continue to work out with resistive exercise machines and free weights and building enormous muscle, which they can maintain even after for a while after they stop the drug. Or whether it's the anti-catabolic effect, that is, the muscle doesn't break down under the influence of these enormous weights, or improved recovery. But, or as John suggested, there may be even a change in a sense of assertiveness and aggression. But my experience, at any rate, is that it is not used and have an effect on the same day. I mean, that's just not the experience I think most of us have with anabolic steroids. Maybe we have to rethink that, but currently that is just not the case. And so it raises some questions which go unanswered. But certainly it is extraordinarily unusual, in my experience, if not unheard of, to say you took testosterone within the 24 hours and then had an incredible performance where you gain, go from 11th to 3rd, gain 8 minutes in this 120-some-odd-mile race, is just off the charts of anybody's experience who deals with anabolic steroids that I know. I'm interested in John's reaction to that.
Well, my reaction is that, as Gary points out, it really takes time to use any anabolic steroid in order to get the kind of strength results that are going to contribute to a performance like that. I think the one rational reason that a person might use it in Landis' circumstance, and he was reeling from a terrible performance the day before, would be as a mood enhancer. When you look at decades of medical literature that address the side effects of testosterone to various kinds of patients, you keep seeing the term well-being, that the taking in of testosterone has been constantly associated with this sort of emotional response, apparently, to the administration of the drug. I think of Andrew Sullivan's New York Times essay several years ago. He takes it because he's an HIV patient. He described this incredible euphoric rush that he got after injecting himself with testosterone. So I suppose it's possible, although I would agree that this is speculation, that this drug, for that particular purpose to serve Landis, is only really conceivable as a mood enhancer that would enable him to recover his self-confidence and make the most of whatever physiological reserves he had.
But usually it's used for endurance and strength, so that would apply to bicyclists, track and field competitors, gymnasts, swimmers, baseball, football, tennis, figure skating. Are there any sports that haven't been touched by a doping scandal? Do you think golfers or bowlers would also?
It's hardly an element of human performance that cannot be affected by drugs one way or the other. You know, if you want to talk about golf, and I don't know if there's any good data on golf, but certainly those who play the game tell me when they get the yips, they'd like to control that the little tremor they have when they're putting. If you want to hit the ball further, the laws of physics say force equals mass times acceleration. Well, same principle hitting a baseball. If you have more mass swinging the club and more acceleration of the club face through the ball, the ball's going to go further. You can almost dissect almost any sport, and I can show you a drug that will probably impact its performance in a positive way.
We have an email from Roger who says, there's a medical service advertised online testosteronetherapy.com, which promises a variety of doctor-administered testosterone therapies with explanations of how negative side effects are avoided. Could such a service be legitimate and safe?
Well, the laws of the land have gotten very strict, and I've been personally involved in that. And just 2 weeks ago, Dr. James Short in North Carolina was sentenced to a year and a day in federal penitentiary for prescribing anabolic steroids and human growth hormone for the purposes of enhancing performance. We just saw the Balco affair, similar kind of thing. Patrick Arnold last week was sentenced to 3 months in federal penitentiary for this. Our sentencing guidelines have increased the penalties for anabolic steroids. We have seen androstenedione, which previously was categorized as a dietary supplement, which is metabolized into testosterone as a thing that becomes testosterone, has been reclassified as an anabolic steroid. I think much of this initiative and it really come from another aspect of this, which has really resonated in a very significant way, and I think people didn't anticipate, is the impact on our youth. Well, we see 4% of high school students having used in the 12th grade anabolic steroids, as many as 2.5% of 8th graders have used anabolic steroids. When we hear about the stories of the Taylor Hooten hanging himself and others who have committed suicide, we realize this is a public health issue as much as a policy issue or a sports issue.
Dr. Hoberman, in recent years, there's been talk of the possibility of gene doping. Can you explain what that is, and do you think it'll become a reality?
Gene doping is a futuristic technique at this point that would involve delivering specific genes to, say, turn on the production of an important hormone. It might be testosterone. It might be natural erythropoietin, the blood-boosting drug. There's a great deal of speculation about gene doping of athletes at this point. Several months ago, I was at a conference where scientists were discussing this. It is conceivable, as far as I can tell, as a non-scientist, real high performances resulting from gene doping are not around the corner, although you will read differently from other commentators.
Now, Dr. Wadler, I just read in the Times that high-altitude tents are being prohibited. Are we going too far? Isn't the whole idea of training to enhance a person's performance? Where do we draw the line? Is it simply with testosterone?
Well, I want to make it clear that WADA has not taken an official position on low-oxygen tents. The way we view, and I'm a member of the List Prohibited Methods Committee, which says what can and cannot be used, and we make recommendations which are reviewed around the world, is that it has to have the potential to enhance performance or has to represent a significant risk to one's health, or it has to violate the spirit of sport or the ethics or the level playing field concept. You have to have at least two out of the three for even consideration. And there is much disagreement philosophically about the ethics of low-oxygen tents. I'm a little bit concerned about the safety of them because at the elite level with highly expensive equipment, there's no question you can regulate the amount of oxygen you breathe in. But I'm also concerned that if people were using faulty equipment, they may have inordinately low oxygen and wind up with permanent brain damage. Although this has not been demonstrated yet, it seems to be something that has to be factored into our thinking. But clearly the issue of oxygen is one that's a subject of vigorous debate, and those
thank you both. We've run out of time, unfortunately. Please Explain today has featured Dr. Gary Wadler and Dr. John Hoberman. It's been really fascinating.